Welcome to episode 32 of the Imperfect Progress Podcast. I'm your host, Anne Guzman. Still a bit of a raspy voice here, but nonetheless, I am excited to share today's episode with you because there's a lot of information here that I rarely see in the mass media. And I think it's important that athletes and active people are learning about heart health and these important factors that could contribute to your heart health later in life and at any age. Today's guest is Dr. Chrisanda Shufelt. She's an expert in women's heart health and menopause. Dr. Shufelt is a professor and chair of the Division of General Internal Medicine. She's a senior consultant at the Mayo Clinic Women's Health and associate director of the Women's Health Research Center at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. She's a women's health internist with fellowship training in vascular biology and women's health, and she's also a certified menopause practitioner. She's the immediate past president of the North American Menopause Society, where she's now on the board of trustees. Dr. Shufelt's current NIH-funded research focuses on young women with hypothalamic amenorrhea, evaluating the impact on immune and vascular health. What do we talk about today? A range of topics. I'm not going to mention them all, but they include how early or late onset of a female's period could contribute to poor heart health later on in life, the effect of undernutrition, overexercise, and stress on female or male hormones, and how these could contribute to changes in vascular health and poor heart health later in life. Dr. Shufelt speaks about premenopause, menopause, postmenopause, and what are the current guidelines for hormonal replacement therapy, and what are the different types of therapy. She also speaks about hormonal replacement therapy for younger female athletes with amenorrhea in relation to bone health. Super important. We cover how changes in hormones affect your vasculature, blood vessels, and veins, and why this is important for athletes now in the moment in relation to your performance, and then potentially later in life in relation to heart health. Dr. Shufelt also shares information about her latest study that is currently recruiting women, so you can get the details of that near the end of the podcast. We talk about how you can get involved, what the criteria are, and even contact information for listeners. I consider myself pretty well informed. However, I was not aware of many of the insights that Dr. Shufelt shared today. They've given me a lot to think about, more information to share and discuss with clients who may be struggling with undernutrition, overexercise, or high periods of stress. Whether you're male or female, this is an important episode to tune into. Coaches, parents, athletes, physicians, we can all take something important away from today's conversation, and it could help you and your future heart health or someone else and their future heart health. So definitely jump inside. But first, if you have not subscribed to my newsletter, the Sports Science Minute, head to my website, anneguzman.com. That's anneguzman.com. Scroll to the bottom of any page and subscribe today. It's a great place to learn and get extra resources on some of my podcast topics and other topics that I discuss. I love the community. I get a lot of feedback about my newsletter, things that people have learned or things that they would like to learn about. If you are subscribed and you're enjoying it, please share it on social media, share it with your friends or teammates or anyone that you think it could help. I appreciate the community. You're all amazing. Thank you for listening. So now let's jump inside and learn from Dr. Shufelt. I'll see you there. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Shufelt. Thank you for joining me today.
And thank you for having me on what I consider a very important topic and very heartfelt for myself.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And yes, it's a super important topic that I think we can all learn more about. I myself, I've learned a lot in the last month, and I'm certain I haven't even scraped the iceberg on this topic. But I think it's a topic that doesn't get enough time in mass media, health and fitness magazines, and even on social media, which is where a lot of people are going to learn now. I think information about heart health is important, and I'd like to be a part of, I guess, helping that information to reach a broader population. One thing that really surprised me in some of the research of yours that I read, there were a few articles in the mass media. I can't recall if it was in the Times or perhaps Cedars-Sinai. They were exciting to see. You were referring to the walking well, and I thought this was so interesting because you were speaking about healthy women who are working out, training, they have a job, they also have somewhat of a stressful lifestyle, but from the outside, they look healthy, they seem fit, but it seems that there are these discoveries that you and your colleagues are making about how this type of lifestyle of an athlete or super active woman could be actually contributing to poorer heart health. This is definitely something I'd love to speak with you about today. I realize there are a lot of factors that can contribute to poorer heart health, but this one actually really surprised me. Before we dive into that, though, I would love to ask, how did you start connecting the dots in all of your research to arrive at this archetype of the walking well?
Yeah, it's a great question. And they look like they're walking well, but they're really the walking unwell, because on the inside, they might be having what we would consider accelerated aging because of things that they're doing on the outside. So my interest really started in terms of women's health. After I did internal medicine residency and then did a women's health fellowship, which is an extra couple years of training, and I specifically concentrated on the heart. And at the time that I did my fellowship training was when there was so much mass confusion about hormones and heart disease. And specifically after the Women's Health Initiative was published in 2002. And that really catapulted my interest in understanding what is the role of estrogen, as well as other hormones in the woman's female body that impacts heart health. And so that was really what drove me. So I started studying older women that had entered menopause because I somewhat became the tiebreaker in terms of the expert on the areas of hormones and heart disease, because women were being told not to go on hormone therapy at menopause. Women were being told that it's bad for them, it's going to cause a heart attack. And so what we've learned in the last couple decades has been really pivotal and important for women that enter menopause. So that's where my interest really started. And then I took a larger step back and realized that estrogen is important across the lifespan. And estrogen isn't just poignant at the time of menopause. Certainly it is, because women present with symptoms of hot flashes and night sweats. But we had a group of a large NIH-funded study of women that were presenting to the emergency room with chest pain. And in this study, which was called the Women's Ischemia Syndrome Evaluation, we looked at the younger women that were coming in with chest pain and going up and getting an angiogram or an actual physical test where we go into the heart and look with catheters to see if there's any blockages. We measured their hormones at the time that they went in, and these were women of reproductive age, younger than 40, and noticed this consistent pattern that the women that had blockages had, at the time that they presented, lower levels of estrogen and lower levels of the hormones and the signals from the brain called a follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, lower levels of those as well. So it drew our attention to, well, if hormones are important at the time of menopause, we need to look back and see what's happening in younger individuals. So that really drove my interest to looking at what I would consider this phenotype, this clustering of symptoms of women who have very low estrogen and very low FSH and LH. And that's where we started to draw a link with heart disease in this condition.
Really interesting. And before we keep going, because I know we've already dropped a lot of terminology in that answer, which I appreciate, it was great. I was hoping we could maybe define a few of the terms before we jump in, because I want to make sure everyone can follow along today who maybe is not immersed in the women's health, reproduction, and science in general, but really wants to learn about this topic. So could we start, before we keep going, by defining some of the terms? I'll mention a few, but we can come back to them throughout the conversation if a new one comes up. But functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, maybe just amenorrhea in general. Estrogen, just what is it and maybe the importance. And then also, how do you define over-exercising, which I think is something we're going to speak about as well. So we can start with functional hypothalamic amenorrhea.
So functional hypothalamic amenorrhea is when a woman is of reproductive age, should be getting her menstrual cycle every month, but has gone 3 or more months without a period. 3 or more months without a period, and is usually due to overexercise, undereating or restrictive eating patterns, or stress. There's likely an underlying genetic component to it, because what is stress to one woman is not the same stress to another woman, where they wouldn't shut down their ability to make estrogen. But it is actually a true form of infertility. Women with this condition stop their menstrual cycles, and therefore, by definition, they cannot get pregnant. They're infertile, essentially. It can be prolonged from months, but it can actually be more prolonged to years. But it is important from a doctor's standpoint that it is a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that we need to make sure other causes of a woman's menstrual cycle stopping have been ruled out. So we have to think about other things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, things like thyroid dysfunction, things like prolactin, which all those can cause the menstrual cycles to stop. And also the number one cause of a woman missing her menstrual cycle is pregnancy. So all of those, while it is a diagnosis of exclusion, it is very exclusive to women that are athletes. It's estimated that about 1 in 4 athletes have this condition at any point in their lifetime. It is a large cause, about 40% of the reason women stop having their menstrual cycles, which is the term amenorrhea. Amenorrhea is without your menstrual cycle. And it's estimated to impact about 1.6 million women in the United States at a given point in time. So not a small condition, and probably a larger condition that's happening in athletes. And again, due to excessive exercise, restrictive eating patterns, or stress, or a combination. And people might be more used to the term athletic triad, the female athletic triad. This is beyond the female athletic triad. The female athletic triad is really exclusive to athletes, but this can actually occur in, you know, someone who's taking care of a lot of their family members or community, or starting a new career or starting a new job, or just having excessive stress or having restrictive eating.
No, that's really helpful. We'll have to pull on that a bit more after we do some definitions, but that you don't have to be an athlete, and just how stress can also impact this part of your biology. So you've also covered amenorrhea, which is great. How would you define over-exercising?
Oh, that's the $50 million question. And one of the things that we're studying right now is we're using a Fitbit device to actually track women with this condition, because again, what is stress to one woman where they shut off their access to reproduce is not the same as the stress to another woman. It's also really hard to measure exercise, because in our initial studies, when I asked the question on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is extreme exercise, how hard do you exercise in women with this condition? It was pretty consistent. Women answered this question as a 7 out of 10. So it's really hard to quantify what is excessive exercise versus extreme exercise. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at right now. But they have quantified it in terms of mileage of long distance runners. They've looked at it in terms of weight. Losing excessive weight can, along with the exercise, can tip you into this condition.
Yeah, I can see why that would be hard to quantify. And especially if someone was very obsessive in nature, and that was now their normal. And so now you're asking, you know, oh, right, do you exercise a lot? But to them, that 25 hours a week is, that's just what they do. So, you
that's
know, that's not too much. Right. That's great. Thank you. And then I know to ask the question, what is estrogen and what does it do? I mean, that could be a course, but I guess in the context of this conversation, if you could just give some basics on, you know, what is estrogen and the largest roles in the body.
So estrogen, or what we would term estradiol, which is what the body naturally makes in the ovary, is produced by the ovary during your reproductive years. It has a beautiful cycle that occurs throughout the month. And then once it drops down, the menstrual cycle occurs, and then it starts to go back up and drops back down again. That's during the reproductive age, premenopausal women, as we would call it. During menopause transition or the perimenopausal years, which can be anywhere from 2 to 7 years before the final menstrual period, you can have those beautiful fluctuations in estrogen, but you can also have it become a little bit more sporadic, where women get symptoms of hot flashes and night sweats. And then finally, the last stage is menopause, and that's your final menstrual period, defined as 12 months of no period. That's menopause. The average age is 52 in the United States, and that is accompanied by low levels of estrogen naturally and normally after menopause. And it's interesting because it's important to understand that half of a woman's adult life is spent in menopause. So that is a normal, natural progression of healthy aging. But what is not healthy aging is when you abruptly stop estrogen at an early age. And so that's really a result of this condition, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. And what we've learned over my research, as well as others that have been in this area, is it is an underrecognized condition. It is understudied, with some of the most recent studies, as opposed to what we're looking at. I mean, we're talking about 2005. So 2 decades really has gone by without really quantifying and doing deep research into this area. But we know from women who undergo what I call surgical menopause, is removing the ovaries, which is a form of abrupt loss of estrogen. We know those women have an increased risk of heart health in the future if they don't go back on estrogen. So really, this is a condition now, looking at young women in their 20s and 30s and perhaps in their early 40s. That abrupt loss of estrogen due to this condition is not a natural and normal thing. So it's important why I say the menstrual cycle is a vital sign.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that the menstrual cycle is a normal, healthy, that menopause is a normal, healthy thing, right? Because it gets villainized and it's a part of a woman's life, and we don't have to make it sound like this awful thing. And it's not to say that there aren't symptoms that feel awful, but is a natural and right. Healthy part of our lives.
It's normal and healthy aging is menopause. And so, but if you do Google the word menopause and you go under images, it's all negative connotation, but women can enter it healthy and natural. And as I see it as an opportunity for prevention at the time of menopause and to assess your symptoms.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. And lastly, because I think we're probably going to speak about vascular health or vascular elasticity, could you just explain, what does that even mean, like your vasculature?
Yeah, so estrogen promotes vasodilation, or opening up of the blood vessels. So when you are exercising, heart rate goes up, there's a larger cardiac demand, so heart demand, there's larger demand to the large muscles. Estrogen itself actually promotes the blood vessels from opening up and vasodilating, so you can get more blood flow to those areas. So that's what I mean by vascular health. Vascular health can mean the vasculature runs throughout the entire body. It's not just in the heart. It's one of the largest areas of our body. It's all the road, the side streets, the roads that go out throughout and supply blood flow to every area of our body. So when we have an ability to measure vascular function non-invasively, so without having to put you into needles and tubes in your body, we can actually measure how well your body responds to vasodilate. And so we can do that through research. It's a research tool, but we can actually measure. And so that really tells you how elastic your blood vessels are. So it's the analogy here is you get a nice rubber band, and it's really fresh and stretchy, and you feel like you can just wrap it around quite a few times because it's got that really nice bounce to it, as opposed to you find that rubber band in the back of the drawer, you pull it out, you're a little bit worried, was it going to snap, or is it just not going to be able to hold what I need it to hold, and should I even consider wrapping it around again? So that's really how well we should think about how the blood vessels respond. Of course, that's involved in heart health. The stiffening of blood vessels is kind of the first in the cascade of developing heart disease, along with some other things such as inflammation and how our body responds in terms of the immune system to heart, that itself. And so that actually, along with risk factors for heart disease. But traditionally, young women in their 20s and 30s or athletes don't tend to have risk factors for heart disease. So that's why it's important that we're studying this.
Super useful. Thank you for that. And the last thing I want to do to kind of set the stage for this is if you could walk us through what is the typical hormonal fluctuations of estrogen during a woman's first period and then pre-post menopause, and then how do those relate to heart health? I think we're going to get to the last part, how they relate to heart health, but I guess to give what is typical or normal. So then that way, when we speak about what I hate to use the word abnormal, but what isn't normal, then we have something to compare to.
Yeah. What's lost is what I would
say. What's lost. Yeah. I know. I don't think abnormal.
So the average age of a woman starting her menstrual cycle, which is called menarche, is the age of 12. And so that's when we start to see estrogen level, estrogen being produced by the ovary, which then can support a follicle, which then can support ovulation, et cetera. So estrogen, we always say that the first day of the menstrual cycle is what we call day one. And then traditionally a cycle is every 28 days. So if you take a 28-day cycle, about days 11 and 12, you're going to see the estrogen level rise. So from days one, you start to see it slowly start to rise up through that mid-cycle. Day 11 to 12 is usually ovulation, which is where it hits its peak. Now, peak ovulation levels are high. And then what happens after that peak is if there's no pregnancy, the levels start to decline and then swoop down. And then we start it all over again at day 28. We go back to day one because the menstrual cycle occurs because there's no pregnancy to support a growing fetus. And so estrogen levels don't need the demand to stay high. So that's an average cycle of a 28 day. Now, as you get closer to perimenopause or menopause transition, as we're now calling it, we start to see these levels somewhat fluctuate. You can have that nice similar cycle before, but then you can actually fall off mid-cycle, not ovulate. After the age of 40, we see less ovulation occurring. So we see that less higher levels between day 11 and 12. And then of course at menopause, the perimenopause transition, I call it the stock market of hormones, right? You're going to kind of be up one day, you might be down the next, you might slowly go up again, and then you might drop again. So it's not really useful measuring hormones in perimenopause because it's really like opening your app now and looking at the stock market. It's not going to tell me what you're going to do tomorrow or the next week. But once you hit 12 months of no period, that's really defined as menopause. And then we start to see the levels consistently stay low. And some women are very sensitive to that. About 80% of women have hot flashes and night sweats. But again, that's a normal transition. The body somewhat gets used to this fluctuation during the transition, and then it goes low.
I love the analogy of the stock market. I guess it might make us as moody as the stock market as well.
It's either stock market or a roller coaster. I don't know which one you want to be on.
Exactly.
It depends on what year it is.
So what are some of the reasons and then consequences of, you know, in the case of an athlete? So earlier you mentioned that, you know, someone being amenorrheic might be because of PCOS or thyroid or, you know, being pregnant. If it was in the reason was over exercising or under nutrition, what other reasons could there be? And what are the implications of starting your period later in life for your heart?
So two questions here. I'll start with the second. What are the implications of starting your period later in life? So studies have found, and we have also shown this, that the later you start your period, also there's really a U-shaped curve for heart health here. The way early you start your period, kind of like what we call precocious puberty, puberty that's happening way too early when you're 9, 10 years old, as well as those women that start their period way much older, like 16, 17 years of age, there seems to be an increased risk at both ends. But as opposed to those women that start at an early, early age, actually, we found a higher trend if a woman starts it later in life. And there's probably two reasons. One being that the women that are starting it precociously, that might be more due to hormones itself, like the ovarian hormones that you're producing, like PCOS type of women, polycystic ovary syndrome, as opposed to the women that are delayed, that might be due to things like what we're seeing, this hypothalamic amenorrhea, where your body's just not making estrogen enough in time. And then finally, you start to catch up. Well, we've seen this impact in future heart disease health, and that's in cohort studies, observational studies, not randomized controlled trials, but of course, an interesting signal. So it does tell you that if your menstrual cycle was delayed, we do see that risk for heart health itself.
When you encounter an athlete of that young age, 15, 16, what I find is difficult when working with young athletes is to speak about life when you're 50 or 60. And, you know, the reality is when I was that age, had you spoken to me about that, I just wouldn't have cared that much. And I think that's true. You know, I don't really remember, but so how do you try to convey the importance of this? If that's not going to work, and tell me if I'm wrong, but which other strategies do you use with athletes of that age to convey the importance of getting their period back?
It's a great question. And I think it can be likened to a lot of other diseases, not just heart disease, but also, you know, things like cancers. You know, how do we convey, you know, somebody telling them that they might be in, not that these are happening, but, you know, your teenagers that might be trying smoking, cigarettes or other smoking devices, how do we convey that that's an increased risk of stroke? Well, you've got to really put it back on the same playing field and really say, well, if you do this, you're going to maybe have more wrinkles or something along those lines. It's the psychology behind that. But when it comes to menstrual cycles, I think, you know, this is a larger societal issue, is that the menstrual cycle really is a taboo. Talking about it really becomes more of a girlfriend effect, that you're just, you sometimes are talking about it with your friends. And I think as providers, as a physician, I think we need to be more comfortable asking younger women about their menstrual cycle. So that's number one, that's important. And the number two thing, especially when it comes to athletes, is what's one of the injuries that's going to put an athlete out? You know, I have a daughter who's an athlete, and I always say, you break a bone, you're going to be sidelined. So that's actually a condition that's happening in women with hypothalamic amenorrhea, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, because we know the estrogen impacts bone. So even if you get a stress fracture in your foot, if you're a long distance runner and you get a stress fracture in your foot, you're laid up for 6 to 8 weeks. So I think that's a poignant. It's not necessarily coming at it from the heart disease. You know, we found this small this signal, early heart disease, but I think it's coming at it from things that will impact right then and there. And impacting your health with a fracture is going to be just as important and has the same outcome, right? In terms of what we want. We want to kind of capture that, oh my gosh, I need to get my menstrual cycle back so that I won't fracture my bones.
Yeah, and you make a really great point about the topic being taboo. And I think it's great to see a lot more conversation about celebrating having a period versus celebrating losing one as an athlete, which I think has been historically part of the culture of like, oh, I'm not getting my period, good for you. But now that narrative seems to be changing, which I think is very positive. But yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if you obviously educate on the real reason, but then focus on performance, because that's what the athletes want, right? They want to perform. So now if you know that you're not going to be able to race or you're not going to be able to train, that's painful for an athlete. Having been one myself, I mean, that's the worst thing, right? And if you can't be consistent, the likelihood of you being as good of an athlete is going down. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And also explaining that estrogen really is in some respect, if it is all estrogen, which I will speak to the fact that I don't think it's all estrogen because this happens in men too. The women just happen to have a menstrual cycle that we can actually have a signal that something's happening. But hypogonadism, which is low sex hormones or low estrogen or low testosterone in men, can also be similarly occurring in men. But it's important to understand that estrogen, you know, it is a vasodilator. It opens up blood vessels. So if I could tell you, having your menstrual cycle every month is going to be, it's going to make you a better performer. It's going to make you a better athlete. It's going to allow your blood vessels to function more efficiently. You know, while I can't measure that theoretically in terms of how much you run without a period versus how much you run with a menstrual cycle, it does come back to a physiology that, you know, estrogen promotes nitric oxide. Nitric oxide in the blood vessel wall opens it up. Opening your blood vessel wall up allows for better performance, better, more efficiency. And so if you can kind of speak on those terms as well, kind of laying the groundwork for really what, you know, this isn't just about having a menstrual cycle. This is also about having hormones in your body that you should have. You know, you're an extreme athlete, you stopped having your period. Well, your best friend might not be a performance athlete and she's getting her menstrual cycle. There's a difference right there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What is a male, like as a female, we have the, as you said, the signal, we've lost our period. So as a male, what are you looking for?
Unfortunately, there's no aha signal like a menstrual cycle. The things that we start to see are things like stress fractures in men. I was contacted by a professional hockey team where there were repetitive stress fractures occurring. And when we got down to it, looking at the hypogonadism that was happening in extreme athletes due to stress and due to extreme measures. So that's one thing that can be looked at in terms of, okay, if somebody has had a stress fracture, it's time to look at the hormones. It's time to look at the signals from the brain that are calling the hormones to be created. So that axis, what I mean axis is it's the signal from the brain to the ovaries or the signal from the brain to the gonads is actually being shut down. And the unfortunate part is that when that axis gets shut down, another axis gets heightened, and that is our stress axis. And so this combination of high stress hormones and low sex hormones, as I'm going to call it, being estrogen or testosterone, is a bad combination. Bad for blood vessels, bad for immune cells, bad for, and again, thinking about the bone, bad for the bone, as you've studied.
Interesting. And earlier you said this doesn't have to be an athlete. So this could just be someone with, I don't say just, this could be someone with a high stress life. How is that contributing without the under eating and the over exercise? Is it that the body isn't differentiating between the type of stress?
I don't know if it's necessarily a consistency of a high stress life that has been studied actually in both men and women. It's more about an inciting event that might be a stressful event that causes an overwhelming amount of emotional stress or physical stress that then causes this axis to shut off. And I give that example because I had a patient and who had gone through a very stressful period being away from her family at a new location. She was starting a career and taking school classes, college classes. And then there was an inciting event that occurred with the loss of a family member. So it's almost like a perfect storm. It's not perfect. I mean, a storm of event that occurs that perhaps is the most common trigger that can shut off this menstrual cycle.
Wow, that's powerful, right? To know that it doesn't have to be intense exercise. It can actually be life stress. And I think I've also met people myself who are just going through a lot and then notice their body changing. Now, we started by speaking about the menstrual cycle and how very early commencement of menarche or late can potentially contribute to poor heart health later on in life. What about if you start menopause early or have menopause a lot later than what would be the average?
So another great question. So premature menopause is defined as menopause occurring under the age of 40. And early menopause is defined as women who enter menopause under the age of 45. And there's a real calling in the menopause society and with menopause practitioners to make providers and women aware that if not contraindicated, those women should go on hormone therapy up until the time of natural menopause, which is 52. Of course, there's women with estrogen-sensitive cancers or a heart attack or blood clots that we know is contraindicated to go on hormone therapy. But if a woman enters menopause at an early age, we do see women have higher rates of cardiovascular disease earlier. And if you compare to a woman who is age-matched, and she went through menopause at 43, let's say, and her best friend is at 43 and still has estrogen, that woman who's gone through menopause early is at that increased risk when you look at age-matched women. So we have seen this phenomenon going back into the 1970s when we've looked at large cohort studies. That was a study done in the Framingham study. So these are all important. And then it's been reproduced in large studies such as the Nurses' Health study. Now, what's been also shown is that if you put a woman on replacement, estrogen replacement, and she's of young age, it should be at a higher level than we use for menopausal symptoms because it should be more physiologic. And so that's what's another important finding really in the last decade that we've started to observe is that we want to really identify women that have entered menopause at an early or premature age and get them on some sort of estrogen if they can through the age of natural menopause. And oftentimes, some young women might not have symptoms of hot flashes or night sweats. Of course, that's a signal for them to go in and seek treatment. But even without symptoms, we do want to carry them through because, again, that age-matched woman that has her menstrual cycle has that own nice, beautiful fluctuating estrogen in her body up through the time of natural menopause.
And what if you have menopause a lot later than the average person?
Yeah, so the average age is 52. By 55, about 90% of women have entered menopause. And I wouldn't say it's not necessarily about the age that you enter menopause, but it goes back to what I mentioned early, which is called what I term is a reproductive lifespan. So the number of years that you've had your menstrual cycle is called your reproductive lifespan. And studies have found that the number of years is 36 or more, that's a pretty healthy reproductive lifespan. If that number of years is shortened beyond that, it's time to start looking at things like risk factors for heart disease and such.
Right. So that can be shortened by starting your period late in the first place, as coming back to what you said, there was a correlation there. You mentioned earlier that for women who have surgical removal of one or more ovaries, that when estrogen was replaced, it didn't necessarily, I'm not sure what the word would be, but remove all the risk for increased heart disease later. So what is the other piece of the puzzle?
Well, we want to replace women who've had surgical removal of the ovaries. And fortunately, nowadays, most women, if they have to have, so surgical menopause is surgical removal of the ovaries. It has nothing to do with the uterus. A lot of women have to get their uterus removed for things like fibroids or heavy menstrual bleeding. So most surgical gynecologists today if a woman's under the age of natural menopause, will leave the ovaries in because they're still the source of estrogen. The uterus is just the source of the menstrual cycle. So that's kind of a practice change that's happened over the last decade, as opposed to what was happening before, which is you go in to get your uterus removed, which is a hysterectomy, and they take out the whole kit and caboodle. They take out both ovaries and the uterus itself, and that woman goes into menopause. So that's, we know leaving the ovaries in, especially if a woman's under the age of natural menopause, is important. Now, it won't let us know when that woman enters menopause because she's no longer going to have a menstrual cycle. So that's a practice change that's happened over the last decade and an important one. But if a woman has opted to have a surgical removal of her ovaries or has had them done at the same time of their hysterectomy, again, if it's not contraindicated, we do want to put women back on estrogen. And that's just not only for vascular health, it's also for bone health. It's also for cognitive health and physiological and psychological health. So that's important up through the time of natural menopause.
And you just mentioned bone health, which made me think about something. If you're a younger athlete then, and you've lost your period, what are the current treatment options for going on estrogen to be bone protective during such a young period in your life?
Yeah, so the 2015 Endocrine Society guidelines on functional hypothalamic amenorrhea suggests that if a woman has gone 6 or more months without a menstrual cycle due to this condition, they should be put on estrogen because of bone health. We're studying how that impacts heart health, but specifically there's a call to protect bones. And one of the disadvantages, so women hit peak bone mass in their late teens, early 20s. So if you could imagine, if a woman is stopping her menstrual cycle during that time, we know estrogen is important for bone health. If they're not going to hit their peak bone mass to begin with. So they're already going to be behind the curve to begin with. And then fast forward 30 years later, menopause occurs and you already have a woman who might be osteopenic entering menopause and then future bone loss occurs. So that's why it's important that that's what was the call to action about the position statement was also really a guideline to suggest that hormone therapy in the form of what they recommend is patches of estrogen should be used in a woman with this condition for bone health. Now, what is not known is how that impacts heart health, and that's what we've been studying.
Super interesting. And I think that a lot of athletes that might be listening to this might know that they've perhaps been under eating, over exercising, and not had their period for some time and hear that and wonder, oh, I should go talk to my GP, which makes me think, do GPs know about this? Or do a lot of athletes go in to their GP and tell them that they've lost their period and just have the recommendation that they go on the pill?
Yeah, so that needs to be understood that the birth control pill is, it's a Band-Aid. It is a false menstrual cycle. It is a estrogen withdrawal menstrual cycle. And the problem with using the birth control pill, as most women go in, they say they haven't had their period, they get prescribed a birth control pill. Well, a birth control pill usually is 3 weeks of active treatment of estrogen, and then anywhere from 5 to 7 days of placebo, which is where you have your menstrual cycle. And that's why it is a false withdrawal period. So in essence, that woman is only getting, if their bone mass is down, only getting 3/4 of what she should be getting for bone health. So, and they're not recovered from their from this pattern of hypothalamic amenorrhea, or they might be, but it's falsely imposing an ideal that they are. And so they might continue with the same habits or extreme exercise because they're getting a menstrual cycle, but in essence, they're not. And they sit with high cortisol levels. So high cortisol, even in the setting of estrogen, might not be good for your bones as well as your heart. And so I guess the underlying message here is to really identify what is the cause of the menstrual cycle from stopping. Is it extreme exercise? Is it the stress? Is it a combination? Is it food intake? And you might feel like I'm eating a lot of calories, but you might not be eating the right calories, or you might be expending more of your calories when you're exercising. So there's that energy imbalance that goes along also with RED syndrome. So that's excessive energy. So that's more common in athletes. And so I think it's important to say, you know, if you go into your doctors, and the other thought is that one of the reasons Endocrine Society called out transdermal patches of estrogen is actually they have better effect on the bone. And you would use them continuously. So you wouldn't have that break And often you would need a progesterone, so you need to talk to your doctor about it. But you, if you go in and your doctor just wants to put you on a birth control pill, you know, seek information from the Endocrine Society or from, you know, NCAA about the menstrual cycle patterns.
And that's so, I guess, almost frustrating because a lot of athletes aren't going to hear this message, right? And if they're not, for some reason, out there reading about this or getting this information, which hopefully we are going to get this message to a lot of other athletes. You know, I think, for example, my GP doesn't know what REDS is, right? So I know him well, we get along. I provided him with some info. I was like, oh, by the way, you know, in relation to bone. So then I always wonder, like, how much do GPs learn, because they have to know a little bit about everything versus, you know, specializing. What would you say that there's, it's more important to perhaps seek out, if possible, a sports medicine doctor, which I would assume would have a lot more knowledge in this area?
Yeah, I think sports medicine doctors are well vetted in this area. But again, it's also it's continuing to make awareness and do research in this area. Because if we don't continue to do research, we're not going to move the needle in terms of this condition. And I mentioned it at the beginning because there's been 2 decades of really stagnant research in this area. And I think that there's probably several reasons for that. Number one, it's a challenging condition to identify, because women aren't seeking treatment because they're not getting hot flashes or night sweats like they would at menopause. So it's also a little bit stigmatized because we're talking about the menstrual cycle. And it doesn't have a medical home, right? You're talking about your GP doesn't know. And there's not, sports medicine is really becoming its own area of expertise beyond orthopedic medicine. And that's really only in the last decade, again, that really we have a specialty called sports medicine. But it's also important to, so I think that we do need to really put our feet forward. You know, this is where athletes can make such a big difference. If this is a condition that's occurring in female athletes, approximately 1 in every 4 female athletes can get this condition, and we're not doing research in athletes, or we're not doing research in women that are stressed and understanding what is the role of low estrogen, high cortisol in our overall health, and how can we really change guidelines? We're not really doing women and men, for that sake, a service. We're doing disservice because, again, this can happen in men. It's not exclusive to women. I always say we better women's health, we better men's health, because we really can study the physiology behind it.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. So education, getting the message out there, more research, and we're definitely going to talk about your study before we get off here today. You mentioned a few things. One was patches versus perhaps taking an estrogen pill. And as a younger athlete who has lost their period, how the patch would be more beneficial for bone health. Now, if you're premenopause and you're experiencing a lot of symptoms, is that also the recommendation during that time if you were to end up on hormone replacement therapy?
So do you mean if a woman has entered menopause early?
No, just a normal, like premenopause, if you had a lot of symptoms, would the treatment for that be hormone replacement therapy? And if so, is there a certain type that is recommended?
So if a woman's having symptoms such as hot flashes and night sweats in her premenopausal years and is getting her menstrual cycle regularly, that's a time to seek treatment because it's probably not hormones. There's many other reasons women can get hot flashes and night sweats. If a woman is having a reproductive estrogen level that fluctuates, she shouldn't be getting hot flashes and night sweats. That's really starting to be exclusive more for the menopause transition and beyond, specifically menopause. We do see hot flashes and night sweats in that 2 to 7 year window before the final menstrual period. But if you're coming to me and you're a 28-year-old woman who's getting her menstrual cycles every month that comes to me and says, I'm getting hot flashes and night sweats, I'm going to take off my hormone binder and just start opening up to other causes, because thyroid dysfunction can cause hot flash, diabetes or blood sugar changes can cause hot flashes or night sweats specifically. you know, cancers can even cause some night sweats. That's accompanied with a lot of other symptoms, such as weight loss, extreme weight loss that's unintentional. And then infectious diseases, infectious causes can cause hot flashes and night sweats. I can't tell you how many patients with COVID would come in and they're having night sweats. So, and viruses can cause it itself. So I wouldn't be putting my blinders onto that.
Right. And what are the guidelines right now around menopause, average age menopause, so not early or late, around taking hormone replacement therapy? Would there be a reason to take it if you are falling within the typical age range of menopause?
Is there a reason to take it if you're falling within the typical range of menopause? So hormone therapy is recommended for women that are having bothersome hot flashes and night sweats. Of course, there is a host of a lot of other symptoms that occur at the time of menopause and menopause transition that can be anything from insomnia. We see anxiety, depression, cognitive changes. We start to see recall. Women say, I know that person's name. I've met them 100 times. I can't remember it. Or they put their keys down. They can't remember it. Frustrating cognitive changes, not very dramatic cognitive changes. And then, of course, we start to see estrogen, like low estrogen levels can also cause things like vaginal dryness. So the time to seek treatment for menopause itself is, of course, if you're having bothersome symptoms, it's interrupting your quality of life. And then it's the time is really to assess what are your risks for being going on hormone therapy, because for a substantial number of women at the time of menopause who are otherwise healthy or without major contraindications, the benefits of going on hormone therapy outweigh the risks. We start to see the risks after about 5 years of continuous use, and that's with an estrogen for the hot flashes, a progesterone to prevent any bleeding if you have a uterus, or menstrual cycles if you have a uterus, keeps that nice and thin. And we start to see a small signal for breast cancer after 5 years of use, but that risk for breast cancer is very similar to what we see for women who are overweight. That woman's risk is about 3 per 1,000 for breast cancer. Hormone therapy, about 3 per 1,000 women after 5 years of use. So really it is a risks benefit ratio. And it's important to seek a menopause provider. And that's where the Menopause Society, which is an academic professional society, North American, for as well as now international, for menopause practitioners that are knowledgeable about the benefits and the risks, as well as can actually provide expert opinion about what would be the best treatment option for you. And of course, for women who can't go on hormone therapy or actually choose not to go on hormone therapy, you don't have to suffer in silence. There are good non-hormone treatments options available. They are oftentimes off-label uses of medications, because really drug companies aren't going to go after generic drugs anymore for indications that aren't where they can be prescribed generically. So we do use a lot of non-hormonal treatments to treat hot flashes. But overwhelmingly, a majority of women can do very well on hormone therapy at the time of menopause, and the benefits outweigh the risks.
No, that's great. I see so much conversation about this right now. It's incredible. So now that someone listening is probably grateful to hear something. And of course, as you said, to seek out an expert in menopause and not on Instagram. Because there seems to be a lot of those that are
menopause
not actual experts.
I jokingly say menopause right now is a really hot word, because it is one of the most commonly Googled words. I mentioned Google images of menopause, but it is actually becoming one of the more common. And it's really made the forefront. I mean, there's a lot out there with social media as well as digital technology for menopause. But I think it's important to find the right avenues of information and get it that it's that it is really the women that you should be seeking information that is accredited and academic.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Thank you. So if we come back to heart health, you know, we started by talking about athletes and this younger age group of women, and not that we're omitting men, but again, there's that obvious symbol of losing the menstrual cycle. What are you researching now, and you know, how can we continue to make sure that we're bringing heart health to the forefront for women? Because you know, it's just not something that's talked about as much.
So I think my overwhelming message is that we're doing research now. It takes about 10 years for heart disease to occur. It doesn't occur overnight. These are things that happen over time in kind of a domino stepwise fashion. And really identifying that first domino in the cascade of heart disease is what's important, because at that point, it's really reversible. And if we can capture women's risk at that early stage, we've done a great service for women's health. So right now, if you look at heart disease in women, all rates of heart disease, luckily, in both men and women are declining. And they've been declining for the last few years. But what's happening in younger women, age 35 to 44, is they've really plateaued. And now in some groups are starting to slowly increase. So what do we look at when we think now 10 years before that age group, and then that puts you right in your mid-20s. And so that's another reason to look at what role a woman's own estrogen level has in her body at that age. And can that be an early sign of stiffening of the blood vessels? And that's really where our research has led us. So our research was started about 8 years ago and funded by the NIH, looking at heart health of young women with functional hypothalamic amenorrhea and comparing them to age-matched controls who had their menstrual cycles every month, and then comparing them again also to older, recently menopausal women who've entered menopause naturally and normal within 3 years of their final menstrual period. And it was to really determine, is there a difference in this blood vessel function? And what our studies have found is that there is a difference. If a woman is having her menstrual cycle stop normally and healthy at the time of menopause, it's a normal progression. It does not result in vascular dysfunction. But if you abruptly stop estrogen at an early age due to functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, we saw a signal for about one in every three women with this condition. Not every woman, but one in every three had what we would call endothelial dysfunction. So the blood vessels are just not opening up and vasodilating, giving oxygen to the muscles and all the organs as it should be. And so compared to their matched controls, those women were. And to put everyone on the same playing field, we knew that the women with functional hypothalamic amenorrhea they had low estrogen. So when we wanted to measure the controls, is we also measured them at a point in that cycle of estrogen where their estrogen would be low. And that was the first couple days of their menstrual cycle. So that's when we measured it. So low estrogen in both controls and low estrogen in women with hypothalamic amenorrhea. And we saw that there was about one in three women in the FHA group that had this blood vessel response. So now the research is now turning to, well, who is it? Is it our over-exercisers? Is it our excessive, you know, extreme athletes? Is it our under-eaters? Or is it our stressors? Or is it kind of a combination of both? So it's really trying to understand and determine who is that one in three, because that's who we need to capture, because this is the first domino. And so we can then help prevent what's happening 10 years from now.
Super interesting. And do you have to lose your period? If you're listening right now and you're a female athlete and you're thinking, well, you know, I kind of restrict my nutrition and I do exercise a lot, but I still get my period. So can that woman still have low estrogen?
Well, by definition, in order to thicken the lining up in the uterus to have a period, you've peaked up into your estrogen. But if your periods start to become irregular, they start to become lighter, more sporadic, that's the signal that you should really think about what you're doing and how it affects the inside of your body. The interesting thing I say is that this condition has also been studied in the animal kingdom, because in the animal kingdom, especially in primates have a specific pecking order. There is a dominant female and there are subordinate females. And the dominant females can harass the subordinate females to the point where they get functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. They get it. They get ovarian dysfunction so much that they stop their reproductive health. Well, that subordinate animal that gets this condition it's almost a stress. It's a stress response, right? It's not an extreme athlete response, but it is a stress response. Those women, those animals are at increased risk for heart health as well as bone health fractures. So it is nice that this is somewhat replicated in a stressed environment at the animal models, but they don't actually stop having their menstrual cycles. They continue to have their menstrual cycles, but so it just likens the fact that our menstrual cycle in humans is a vital sign again, like I said, but it's a signal for us to know that something's not right.
Mm-hmm. No, that's powerful and very interesting. So I'm listening right now. I'm an athlete. I am an endurance athlete. You know, I restrict a little bit. I exercise a lot. I'm on the pill. What am I looking for? I just need to eat more. I need to train
less.
Well,
if you're on the pill, you're getting a cycle.
Exactly.
Meaning you're getting a false cycle. You're getting a withdrawal bleed. But if you went on the pill because you were not getting your menstrual cycle, that's when you need to think about, well, am I really doing myself? If I haven't changed my habits, how do I know if I'm going to recover from this condition? And so that might be a conversation you'd have with your provider. Maybe hold your birth control pills and see if your cycle regains. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, this is also a sign of infertility. Because women with this condition, who's not getting their menstrual cycle every month, and oftentimes this is one of the key reasons women seek treatment, is because they stop their pill and they don't regain their menstrual cycle. So they seek treatment to try to see why their menstrual cycle is not regained and if you can get pregnant.
Yeah. And I was going to ask that, but I assume that it would be a very difficult thing to study, but perhaps there's some observational data. What data are there to show if you did lose your period as a young athlete, is it more difficult for you to become pregnant in later in life?
So if you did lose your period at an early age and getting pregnant later in life, there's no association between this condition and fertility. That's the beautiful thing, is that it's functional. So it is reversible, this condition related to pregnancy. So that's, I always tell women, and one of the hormones I measure tells me about egg quality and count. And so that actually tells me that this is not menopause. This is not your final menstrual period where you're going into menopause. This is it's almost a protective effect. Your body is shutting down. It's saying, okay, you're so stressed out, or you're not providing me enough energy. You're not providing me enough nutrients. Therefore, you're expending your energy too high that you're not going to be able to carry a fetus full term. So, and so that's the beautiful thing, is that you reverse the condition, you reverse the underlying cause, and fertility oftentimes regained, or oftentimes women can get pregnant with the help of a reproductive endocrinologist.
Right. Well, that's great to know that it is reversible, and that's encouraging, right? If someone wants to change their situation. Is there anything else that you want to cover, or are there any studies that you're running right now that you want to share where people can maybe sign up and be a participant?
Absolutely. So at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, we are actively recruiting right now for 100 women with functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, not on hormones. We don't want to see what the impact of hormones is. We want to see what is the impact on heart health. And so it's a 3-month participation. Women can continue about their daily activities, routine life. But what we do is we bring women onto our campus. We have a travel stipend to fly women down here. And we do these blood vessel testings, and we see how bouncy or how stiff the blood vessels are. And then women wear a Fitbit watch continuously for 3 months. We're gathering exercise information, sleep information, heart rate, along with hormone levels at entry and then at exit of the 3 months. And so it's a 2-time visit to our Jacksonville campus that would be covered by a travel stipend, but it gives you more information, and it'll give us information, and it will help recreate guidelines. It will help change really the footprint of how this condition is being treated, because the purpose of the study, again, is to identify, is it the extreme exercisers? Is it the under eaters? Is it stress? Or is it a little combination of all that's causing the 1 in 3 women to get this rubber band that's not really bouncy. It's the back of the it's the back of the drawer rubber band as opposed to your brand new one. So so that's what our research is. It's considered minimal risk because all it's involving is non-invasive, and it does have a blood draw, but at the entrance and at the end, and then we send questionnaires through the internet, so you could complete everything else online. So if anyone's interested, I'm certainly would be happy to share the information with you, and then I could probably put it up on our you can put it up for the podcast. I can also give you our coordinator's phone number if you would like to hear our how to contact our research coordinator, who is by all means you could leave a message, but the phone number is 904-953-9805. So it's women who've missed three or more periods in a row due to stress, intense exercise, or reduced calories, and 18 to 40 years of age, because after 40, we start to go into that perimenopause transition. So we want to capture the truest of this condition. And really the purpose of the study is to evaluate heart health in young women and to determine if there's a relationship. So I would absolutely love it if anybody, and then you could join us here on the campus and be involved.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. I'll definitely share this. And anyone who's listening, definitely check it out and sign up if you can. Is there anything else you wanted to mention before I ask you the last question of the podcast?
No, I thank you for making awareness about heart health and hormones and young women. So this is fantastic. Because I think nowadays with technology, oftentimes I can give a lecture to 100 doctors, and you get well more noticed in terms of information disseminated right to the source with podcasts. I think this is a fantastic and educated podcast such as yours is important for such a breadth of topics. So thank you.
No, thank you. I agree. I think it's so important to get these messages out there. And unfortunately, a lot of people aren't swiping on PubMed the way they are on Instagram. So here we are. Well, the last question of my podcast that I ask every guest, because I know you're an incredible scientist, but I also love to hear a little bit more about you. And, you know, you, as I said in the introduction, you've just accomplished so much. And I know that that doesn't come easily. And my podcast is named Imperfect Progress. And that's because I love science. And I know that science is very imperfect and the outcomes are not always linear and life is the same. And I always hope that my guests can maybe offer some insights to anyone listening who might be on a path towards whether it's education or sport or just life, and they're running into obstacles or, you know, things that didn't turn out quite how they expect. So I would love it if you could share how you overcome, work with, or manage imperfect progress and adversity when you've faced it through your life and career so far.
Well, you know, I give lectures to the residents about career trajectories, and you always like to think of there's this beautiful straight line that's always like facing upward. But in actuality, it's a real curved, squiggly line, you know, sometimes going up, sometimes going down, because it really does take persistence and never giving up to follow your dream. So I think the ultimate, you know, the goal, whenever I faced adversity, especially through my training, because, you know, having gone through undergrad and then medical school and then residency and then fellowship and then joining faculty and then becoming president of a medical association and then assistant professor, associate professor to full professor, that doesn't happen in a straight line. That is always curved back and forth. And so it's about conversations like this. It's about making what is your passion and what is your ultimate goal in life. When I set out to become into women's health, my goal was to better women's health. And then my goal was to become touch more women's lives worldwide. And so, you know, when I had that in mind, when I started out doing research, I thought I could really, you know, move the needle a little bit. Until one of my papers was published in Australia. And I was like, wow, I have actually made a difference, probably in someone's life that's sitting on the other side of the globe. So those are small, you know, kudos to the fact that it keeps me going and it keeps me really passionate about it. And I think there's an ever-changing landscape that makes it very exciting. So when adversity hits and when you're kind of fitting down, or when you have, you know, what everybody's walked through, which is the imposter syndrome, you know, when you're saying, is this possible for me to do this? It's important to realize that there's a woman out there or a man out there that has a spouse or has a daughter that you're making a difference. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, that's what gets me up, keeps me going. It makes me excited. I'm passionate about what I do. If it hasn't come across in my voice, I hope it has. But I'm also, you know, I really want to make a difference overall in the health of women.
And you are. So thank you for all the work that you do. It's super important. And we know that women's heart health doesn't get the attention, partially maybe because of how it presents as well, but obviously because of the amount of research and the area that you're focused on is something that definitely hasn't had a lot of attention. So we appreciate everything that you do, and thank you for that. And I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. Thanks
so much. Where can people learn more about your research?
So you can look at my clinical profile on the Mayo Clinic website. You can look up my name. I'm also on Twitter at C. Shufelt, MD, as my Twitter handle. And I usually post mostly breaking research that we're doing here at Mayo Clinic, but also other interesting research specific to women's heart health and young athletes as well.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you picked up some important information. And I feel like this really put a spotlight on, once again, the importance of optimal nutrition, making sure we're getting enough rest with our training programs, and finding strategies to manage our stress in everyday life, because they can all impact our current and future health. To stay updated on future episodes, subscribe to my podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever platform you listen to. On Spotify, you can also rate the show by clicking the three dots on the top right hand of the page. And on Apple, scroll down to the bottom and give it a 5-star rating if you liked what you're learning. You can support me and my podcast by subscribing to the podcast, giving it a rating, or sharing it with family and friends and teammates who you think could learn something from it. And of course, if you're interested in being a sponsor, reach out to me through my website, and I would love to see if we could build a partnership. And until next time, stay tuned, because I have some exciting episodes coming up around the power of your brain during performance, strength and conditioning for power sports and for masters athletes, some interesting topics around sports psychology, all the big questions that we have around that, and a lot of other exciting topics and guests that I have lined up. But until next time, just remember that progress is imperfect. And what's more important is that you keep on putting one foot in front of the other, surround yourself with good energy, trust the process, and believe that you will get to where you're headed, even if the path looks different than you imagined. So we will see you next time.